Lecture 11, The Lockean Moment.
Welcome to Lecture 11, The Lockean Moment. As we said at the start of our last lecture, Locke's epistemology will become the dominant theory of knowledge for the 18th century, affecting a vast revolution in the culture sense of the nature of knowledge and of the limits of natural knowing. Given the crucial importance of that, what were the essential qualities in the culture's Lockean revolution? In Locke's model, the mind is, in his phrase, a tabula rasa, a blank slate, on which nature, through sensation and reflection, through experience, imprints our knowledge of the world. Ideas of the natural order by means of sensation, and ideas of mental and volitional activities by means of reflection. In Locke's model, some ideas attract each other for reasons we don't wholly understand, but which are an observable fact of the operation of the mind. And there is what Locke terms an association of ideas by which certain ideas attract others into complex ideas. But above all else for Locke, the mind is active. The mind works at acquiring knowledge by means of sensation and reflection. The mind works by abstraction, generalization, and combination to form complex ideas about the reality in which it finds itself. From those ideas, it forms propositions about the world. But because those propositions are based upon experience, and because there is no logical reason, no necessity for experience to remain the same, those propositions may only be probable, and the degree of their probability depends upon their relationship to experience. Think, Locke asks, about someone who has lived all of his or her life in the tropics. And you say to that person, I know people who can walk across a river. The person from the tropics will say, but that's impossible. You can't walk across a river. And you say, well, water becomes thick and hard. Person from the tropics says, no one ever, neither I in my lifetime, nor in 1,000 prior lifetimes, has ever experienced such a thing. Well, if you're from the tropics, and someone makes that claim to you and you know nothing else, you indeed deem it highly improbable because it is absolutely unsupported, indeed contradicted by your experience of the world. But the first time you experience ice, the first time that you experience the freezing of water, what do you do? Declare that the phenomenon is not part of your experience now? No. You change your ideas and you change your propositions about the world. There is this categorical difference between logic and experience. In logic, something is entailed. It is necessary. Three must be larger than two. If two of the angles of a triangle add up to 120 degrees, the third angle must be 60 degrees. Those are logical relationships. But you could attend a meeting every day of your life for 40 years at which there are three people. And if someone says tomorrow there will be three people, that's highly probable. If you're a betting person, by all means wager on it, but there is no logical necessity, as there was in the case of the triangle or the relationship between three and two, why tomorrow there would not be four people or one person at the meeting. You're in the same position as the person in the tropics who never has seen water frozen and hard. So all of our propositions, not about logic, but about the world in which we find ourselves, may only be probable. You land on an island. The first 100 people you meet have red hair. It is highly likely that the 101st person will have red hair, but it is not logically necessary. You cannot even say by any means all people on this island have red hair. All you can say is all people I have met on this island thus far in my experience have red hair. So our knowledge of the world is always probable and always open to emendation on the basis of further experience. Locke's model, based upon the origin of our knowledge in experience, the origin of our knowledge in units of experience from which we have built our complex ideas, our propositions about the world, indeed, our most complex theories of the world. Locke's model leads to a demand for analysis, for clarity, and for confirmation. You need not be impressed, if you are a Lockean, by the complexity of language of a theory, by the intelligence of the proponent of a theory, by the symmetry or beauty of a theory, by the intricacy or seeming profundity of a theory, because none of those qualities makes something probable or improbable. If someone makes a claim upon your belief, if someone says to you, here is what you should believe about the world, here is what we know to be true, and you are a Lockean, you have not only the right, but if you think clearly, you have the intellectual obligation to say, how do you know that? What experiences support and confirm your view? What in experience allows one to make that claim about the world? In theory, if one is a Lockean, any proposition whatsoever may be analyzed, broken down into its component ideas, and then into its component complex sensations and reflections, and then into its component simple units of experience, and may be judged in relationship to the actual human experience of the world. The world of real knowledge, then, in the Lockean revolution, becomes, by analysis and experimental confirmation, a lucid world, an accessible world, an unmystifying world devoid of obscurity when it makes the only appropriate claims of human knowledge, probabilistic propositions about the world on the basis of human experience. Take what was most complex in systems and in claims of knowledge. Analyze that into its simple parts and confirm or disconfirm propositions about the world by comparing them to the actual behavior of the things described. This becomes, in so many ways and in so many disciplines and in the reexamination and criticism of so many systems and theories, the mission of the 18th century. And it is a mission bequeathed by Lockean epistemology. Let's talk about the implications of John Locke's model, of his epistemology. Some in the 18th century will attempt to mechanize Locke's view of the mind and of the formation of knowledge, consistent with the 17th century's view that mechanization of natural phenomena is the truest and most useful formulation about them. And people will attempt to devise theories of the mechanics of mind, the automatic behavior of mind, the rules governing thinking. For such people, they want a theory that will get us from sensation to complex judgment, all by the mechanisms of mind. Thus, someone who claimed to be a fervent Lockean in the French Enlightenment in the 1760s, a man by the name of Helvetius, wrote in what he believed to be Lockeanism, sentir, c'est juger. To sense is to judge. To have a sensation is to make a judgment. But such a view of John Locke distorts his philosophy quite dramatically. That to have a sensation for Locke is merely to acquire an idea. And as Rousseau will argue, who defends Locke's notion of the active mind, there is no direct route from sensation to human judgment, from sensation to human understanding, because the mind is an active agency. We can teach ourselves to think more clearly. We can correct our habits of mind on the basis of our experience of mind. The mind is an active agency whose underlying nature we do not know, whose behavior we know. But one of the things we know about that behavior is the mind is active. For Locke, and this is a dramatic implication, if there are no innate ideas, if all ideas are acquired by human experience, then we learn our ethical ideas by experience as well. How is it possible to learn ethical ideas by experience? Locke argues that we have sets of experiences that lead to our well-being, and we call those experiences good. We have another set of experiences that lead to our suffering, and we call what leads to our pain evil. And by associating certain things with pain and certain things with well-being, we frame the ideas of good and evil. Now, this model might sound dramatically like Thomas Hobbes's ethical relativism, that all we mean by good is that which we believe will cause us pleasure. All we mean by evil is that which we believe will cause us pain. But in Locke's philosophical system, the assumption is that this is governed by divine providence. That in the same way that we have rainfall and crop growth, in the same way that we have eyes for seeing, as Newton put it, the fact that we have two eyes, two lungs, shows us that there is a design in nature, that God's providence rules the world, that the system has been wisely designed. That sense of providential order suffuses Locke's notion of learning ethical ideas with a providential order, that God has so designed the world that we learn about the good by our experience of happiness, that we learn about evil by our experience of pain. Now, we might first form, on the basis of inadequate experience and testing, we might form hasty judgments about good and evil. I feel terrific drinking these 2 gallons of wine. That must be good. Losing self-control, we discover the next morning that we have paid a price. And it will not be the case that eat, drink, and be merry, abandon all responsibility, leaves you in a fabric of decent relationships, stable society, love, friendship, merit, respect, people who will honor their agreements with you. God has so constructed the world that we learn about real goodness by our experience of well-being. We learn about real evil by our experience of pain. That model, if not joined by a sense of providential design, would be subversive indeed. But undergirded by a sense of providential order, it reinforces the emerging view that Newton announces so clearly, that the more we study nature, the more we see God's wisdom, God's design, God's handiwork. But let us think about other implications of John Locke that will have the profoundest and most long-term effects on some of the most essential and contested Western ways of thinking. If Locke is correct, that is to say, if one is a Lockean, and people learn their ideas about the world, including their ethical ideas about the world, from experience, then what an environment rewards and punishes will shape the sense of good and evil in the people produced by such a society. Control the environment. Alter the environment, you control or alter the ethical ideas of the human beings produced by any given system or society or place or family. That is a notion that will have a long and independent and dramatic history in Western thought. Or consider the relativistic implications of Locke. If our ideas are bound and limited by our experience, then all of your ideas are relative to the time, place, and circumstances of your life. If your ideas are bound by your experience, then it follows absolutely that that experience, which is to say the time, place, and circumstance of your life, will determine what you understand about the world, how you judge the world, what your ethical standards and values are in the world. It does not follow from that in Locke that we cannot argue as human beings on the basis of broader and long-term experience. There is no absolute relativism that follows that would cut short the bringing to bear of broad and long-term human experience upon questions. But it nonetheless absolutely follows that what you believe and what you value is relative to time, place, and circumstance. That idea, to say the least, will have a long and independent history in the West. Consider also the issue of character development. In the Aristotelian scholastic model, everything, including every individual human being, has a fixed essential quality, a fixed essential character, an essence. If you look at medieval and 16th century drama, poetry, theater, what do we have? We have the saint and the sinner, the virtuous person and the vicious person, the hero and the coward. We have fixed essential qualities that clash. We have the fatal flaw of a tragic hero that plays itself out and determines that figure's fate. But now, what would follow in a culture that became Lockean? It would become interested in how people became who they are. What made people what they are? There would not be fixed essential characters. And you would expect to see exactly what you see all throughout the 18th century and after. Developmental novels, developmental plays, developmental biographies in which, by understanding the childhood, the experiences, the particular time, place, and circumstance of someone, the particular interactions, we come to understand how someone became who he or she is, how someone developed a character. For character now is not essential or fixed. It is acquired. It is developmental. What a dramatic transformation in the way we think about human beings, and obviously, what a dramatic transformation in the way in which we would think about politics and society and their effects upon individuals and characters as well. There are two dramatic problems bequeathed by Locke to his culture, and indeed two questions that will obsess the 18th century. The first is what is known as the specter of philosophical idealism. Idealism meaning that if all that we know are our ideas, and if we cannot know what corresponds to our ideas, what really is out there that gives rise to and corresponds to our ideas, then all that we know are the contents of our own minds. All that we know as ideas. The world is known as idea, not as substantial reality. That problem of potential philosophical idealism follows from Locke, and it will be grappled with throughout the 18th century and indeed beyond. The second dramatic question bequeathed by Locke is, how does one demonstrate the truth of religion if all of our knowledge is probabilistic and acquired by experience? And it leads Locke to write one of the great works of late 17th century Christian apologetics, recalling, as always, that apologetics means defense of the faith, not apology for the faith. Locke's work, The Reasonableness of Christianity, published in 1695. What does an empiricist's defense of Christianity look like? Why is it reasonable to be a Christian? We will see Locke's mind at work in his apologetics. First, my metaphor, it's not Locke's, to give you a sense of how he is thinking. Supposing you walk out one day from your house, and you see that the clouds have formed a message in the sky. Alan, you're wrong. I exist. God. Your first thought is you might be hallucinating, dreaming. So you test for dream, you're awake. You might be hallucinating. You knock on people's doors, you say to your neighbors, what do you see up there? And they say, oh, the clouds have formed themselves into the words, Alan, you're wrong, I exist, God. Now, if we're in the 20th century, we think it must be skywriting. Someone's playing a practical joke. But we know that skywriting, the wind would disperse the clouds, and it stays there. Now, if you're a reasonable person, if you're a reasonable person, would you do whatever the clouds next said? Would you believe whatever the clouds next told you? If you walked out and one day those clouds said, right, John, you're wrong, I exist, God. And then 5 minutes later, it said, short IBM. Boy, you would mortgage the house, right? You'd be the most unreasonable person in the world not to. Why? Because that miracle is a stamp from God. That miracle tells you this comes from God. And you would have to be a madman. You'd have to be an imbecile. You'd have to be the most unreasonable human being in the world not to believe and do what that said next once you knew its author, God. Well, Locke argues in The Reasonableness of Christianity that we have unimpeachable witnesses to certain phenomena, the apostles. They didn't get rich from what they did, quite the opposite. Some people will lie, they get rich, they profit. The apostles claimed to see certain things on the basis of which they were willing to undergo imprisonment, torture, and death. Those are pretty good witnesses to have, right? If you were in court, and you could produce witnesses who, in order to tell the truth about you, were going to be put to death and tortured. You couldn't ask for more unimpeachable witnesses. That's what we have in the apostles. And what do they tell us they saw? Lazarus raised from the dead. Food brought down from the heavens. Storms calmed. Christ risen after 3 days. The fulfillment of prophecies in the ministry of Christ predicted in the Old Testament, that is God's empirical stamp upon Scripture, acquired by experience. And on the basis of that stamp of divine origin, it now is reasonable, indeed, it would be an act of madness not to, it now is reasonable to believe the content of Scripture rationally and reasonably read and understood. The drama is we have here a new philosophical defense of Christianity, self-confident, based upon empirical evidence of the truth of Christianity. The other side of that drama, as we shall see when we look at the 18th century, is it invites some of the most curious, interested, and remarkable minds of the 18th century to examine the question, did the miracles actually occur? Were the prophecies actually fulfilled? The legacy of John Locke, in all of its aspects, is a dramatic one. Thank you very much.